It's a great pleasure to have Delilah Gates with us today from Harvard, telling us about photon emission from circular equatorial orbitals around curved black holes. Thanks very much, Delilah, for agreeing to give a talk here, and we look forward to your talk, so please take it from here.
Great, thank you so much for the invite. I actually did summer research at Perimeter when I was an undergrad, so it's nice to virtually at least be visiting you all again.
Nice, yeah, it's great to have you back.
So let me go over a summary of results. So as the first slide suggested, we're going to be talking about curved black holes and specifically circular equatorial orbiters around the curved black hole. And this is based on work for which the archive number is listed here that I did with my collaborators, Shahar Hadar and Alex Lubsaska. And so for these circular equatorial orbiters, the first thing we do in this work is we generalize the notion of the critical curve, or the curve that delineates the black hole shadow. If we think about a backlit black hole, we generalize this notion of the critical curve to not just an observer far from the black hole, as described by screen coordinates alpha and beta, theoretically, as was done by Bardeen. We take this notion of these screen coordinates and generalize them not to an observer infinitely far away from the black hole like Bardeen described, but for one of these circular equatorial orbiters. So now the observer is in the bulk. And in particular, when we generalize this notion of the critical curve, we're able to use it to understand some properties about emission that is isotropic and monochromatic from these circular equatorial orbiters. And particularly the two properties that we focus on are the escape probability, how much of the light emitted from these orbiters reaches the celestial sphere versus falling into the black hole, and of the emission that escapes the celestial sphere, what is the redshift, what is the flux as a function of the redshift of this emission. And in particular, after we discuss these, we're going to go into specifically talking about this critical curve and, of course, the escape probability and flux in the extremal regime, because there's some interesting caveats about how you have to think about drawing the critical curve in order to answer these questions for how much escape probability or flux we have when the black hole is at its maximum spin. And then finally, time permitting, I'll touch on some aspects of what implications this has on observing black holes and possibly using this emission to think about how we might, if we were observing a black hole, constrain, say, its spin. So the first thing in order to do this is I need to talk about the Kerr bound orbits and what's called the critical locus. So here, of course, I have for you in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, the hero of all this work, the Kerr metric, which we use to describe a spinning black hole's geometry. And of course, it's governed by two main parameters, the mass of the black hole, M, and this parameter, A, which is related to the angular momentum of the black hole. Of course, J, the angular momentum of the black hole, is equal to A times M in natural units. In particular, around a Kerr black hole, the trajectories of the particles are determined by three conserved quantities, the energy, the angular momentum about the axis of rotation of the black hole, the spin axis, and a more mysterious quantity called the Carter constant. For photons, the case simplifies even further in that if we are to look at the form of the momentum of a photon in the Kerr geometry, really we only need to consider two of the conserved quantities to be able to define the trajectory the particle, the photon, will take through the Kerr geometry from its source to where it's observed. In particular, what we notice is if we take the momentum of a photon and we write it instead in terms of a normalized angular momentum about the spin axis and normalized Carter constant, the energy becomes an overall multiplying factor. So really it's the angular momentum and Carter constant that tell us all about the behavior of the photons. Furthermore, the Kerr geometry has a special region where you can have bound orbits for photons. This region has been recently interest of study and understood more as spurred on by the observational results from the EHT, which gave us the first up-close image of the emission region of a black hole. And so this region where Kerr geometry has bound photon orbits is called the photon shell. And it, for Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, happens in a range of radii around the black hole, which we call R tilde minus to R tilde plus. And the extent of the photon shell is dependent on, of course, the parameters of the black hole, its spin and its angular momentum. Angular momentum and mass. And the photon shell has its greatest extent when the black hole is at extremality, or maximum spin, A equals M in natural units. And when the black hole is Schwarzschild and A is set to zero, the photon shell shrinks down to a single radius, the photon sphere. Now, just because a photon is in the photon shell doesn't mean it will be on one of these bound orbits. In particular, to be on one of these bound orbits, it needs to have its angular momentum and Carter constant tuned to this specific form. However, of course, these bound orbits are unstable. And so realistically, if a photon gets knocked off of one of these orbits just slightly, it'll either spiral into the black hole or eventually spiral out to infinity. And this is the reason that in the photon shell, photons can orbit multiple times around the black hole before reaching their ultimate destination of the horizon or the celestial sphere, which leads to self-similar images of the emission of a black hole. And this is the underlying property of what's called the photon ring, that bright ring kind of image you see on all these GRMHD simulations, though it's not quite the subject of this talk. So the subject of this talk in particular is the critical curve. And so the critical curve is based on what's called the critical locus. If we think about the mapping the angular momentum and Carter constant for the bound photon orbits into a curve in lambda eta space, we get this critical locus. Here I'm showing it for spin zero. Here I'm showing it for maximum spin. And if we then take this curve and we map it onto the sky of an observer, it gives us what is called the critical curve, which is this exactly what I mentioned in my little introduction, the black hole shadow, or the shape of the black hole you would see as its silhouette if it was backlit. And here are some examples of just what I was saying for that case. Where we see a backlit black hole, we get a depression from a certain region within inside the critical curve. And so even though the critical curve itself is not actually an observable curve, what it does for you is it delineates the region in which you could aim photons and have them either fall into the black hole from the region of where you aim black photons back into the geometry, and they would go off to infinity after approaching the black hole. And in particular, in the Bardeen coordinates for describing a black hole that is generally used to describe how we quote unquote see a black hole, theoretically, we can relate the coordinates on the screen, alpha, which goes in this direction, and beta, to the conserved quantities that describe the motion of the black hole, lambda and eta, in this specific manner. Since we want to describe this same curve for observers or orbiters that are in the bulk and not at the celestial sphere, we need to change our notion of what we call alpha and beta, these screen coordinates that describe what we see as the black hole. So instead, we will generalize this notion of the screen for these circular equatorial orbits by replacing the idea of this alpha beta screen coordinates for the Bardeen coordinates by the coordinates of the quote unquote sky of one of these orbiters. So in particular, we will go into the rest frame of one of these circular orbiters, and we will use its sky all directions. It could look around as a screen. And so in particular, we're going to study circular equatorial orbiters. We're going to terminate our which orbiters we consider at the ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit. So when we go to the orbiter frame, in particular, we're going to define a set of coordinates, not to be confused with my Boyer-Linkwitz coordinates that I showed you earlier. We describe them with these parentheses around their coordinates. And what we do is we set up a coordinate system. Time remains the same. But what we call our theta and phi, we set up a Cartesian-like coordinates with theta being the axis in this coordinate system of the orbiter that is parallel to the spin axis of the black hole. And this phi direction, we call the direction of travel of the orbiter, with positive phi being in the direction of travel if the orbiter is prograde, or opposite the direction of travel if the orbiter is retrograde. Then it's easy to describe physical angles in this orbiter sky based on different directions it could be receiving or sending off photons. In particular, the two angles that we can physically describe are the angle from the axis parallel to the spin axis of the black hole, this big theta, as well as this big phi, which is the angle from this positive theta, the direction of travel for prograde, or opposite the direction of travel for retrograde. And then, of course, these are a weird set of coordinates to use. So if we want to use one of them as our angle from the zenith, we can project the other one, either this angle I call epsilon or this angle I call big phi, to get a nice normal set of coordinates on the sphere. I can also define the direction to the black hole. This is the direction that no matter which radius I have my orbiter at will always get captured by the black hole, and this in particular is lambda equals eta equals zero, and I have to be shooting the photon towards the black hole, not away from it. And in the Bardeen coordinates, this is always at alpha equals beta equals zero. I can take the limit of this direction to the black hole and see it takes this form, which is good because this is really just RS times alpha and RS times beta. So indeed, this is the correct generalization of my Bardeen screen coordinates. And then finally, like I said, for the flux piece, I'm going to want to consider the redshift. So I also should keep track of what the redshift is for every direction I could aim my photons. And in particular, a funny thing can happen in that once the orbiter is in the ergosphere of the black hole, I may have some directions I could shoot off my photons that would have formally a non-positive value of redshift. This is not worrisome, it turns out, because if I do now draw my critical curve in the sky of the orbiter, if I ever have a direction that has a negative redshift, it would always be in the region of the sky that is going to be where the light is shot, where the light will be captured by the black hole. All right, so now that I have a nice set of screen coordinates, I can easily draw my critical curve on this sphere for depending on the position of my orbiter, I'll get a different shape of the critical curve. And then now I can tell which directions correspond to capturing for light getting captured by the black hole if it's shot off from my orbiter versus escape to the celestial sphere. Now I could just draw it on the surface of the sphere, but it turns out to answer my two questions about the escape probability and the flux, the easiest way to do this is to take my sphere, that is the sky of the orbiter, and actually do a projection of it. In the case of an isotropic monochromatic emission, of course, the escape probability is really just looking at the ratios of the area on the surface of this sphere that is the orbiter sky corresponding to capture and corresponding to escape. So this leads me to, at least for the purposes of describing the escape probability, considering a projection of my orbiter sky, which is an equal area. So what I do is I make a projection that has the area of the that has its area equal to the area on the surface of the sphere. And when I do this, in particular, we've chosen a specific one which takes this negative theta direction and puts it in the center, and this phi, and this positive phi becomes the outer annulus, and we can see the plus r and minus r, minus theta, plus theta, map to these specific points here. When I do this, I can then plot my critical curves for different radii. Here I'm showing a black hole spinning at 99% of externality. The different colors label different radii for the orbiters. And these dots here along, these colored dots along this horizontal axis label the direction to the black hole. So then I know which area on this projection, once the total area of the projection has been bifurcated by the critical curve, I know which area corresponds to capture and which corresponds to escape. And then it's as simple as figuring out how much area is in the escape or capture region. In this case, I've written in terms of the capture region. And I'm able to then, from the graphically, numerically integrate the area, and I can find the escape probability for a black hole of any spin and an orbiter of any radius up to the ISCO on one of these circular orbits. In particular, here what I've plotted for you is in different colors, the different spins, and I've plotted you the escape probability for radii from 10m all the way down to the ISCO. So we see for the Schwarzschild case in green that this curve gives me the escape probability as a function of the radius of my orbiter. And then I have shown a couple of different examples all the way up to the purple, which is the case for maximum spin. And namely, what's interesting to see is no matter what the spin of my black hole is, this escape probability never dips below 50%. And additionally, I have in this dotted line is just showing what all the ISCOs go to if I was to continue to draw several of these curves for all different spins. These are as I spin up from zero all the way to extremality, where the ISCOs map to, kind of to show you the envelope of all the escape probabilities for these orbiters on all these circular orbits down to the ISCO for all spins. All right, so this gives me the escape probability. Now let me turn to the case of the flux for the emission that escapes as opposed to being captured by the black hole. For this, instead of using the same projection of an equal, an area-preserving projection of my orbiter sky, instead here we consider a redshift-weighted projection. So in this, in particular, the area on my projection will be equal to the area on my orbiter sky weighted by the redshift. And in particular, when I do this, what I get are maps that look something like this. In this case, we've chosen instead to project this plus phi direction to the center, minus phi direction to the outer ring. And the outer ring may, the outer ring actually may not actually be this outside point back here. It might cut off if the redshift drops to zero. So these plots only have on them points in the orbiter sky where the redshift is positive. And in particular, the shaded region on these different plots is the capture region. Further, these plots, you'll notice, unlike the case for my area preserving projection, these, I no longer plot them on the same plot, and in particular these plots have different areas overall, and this is indeed physical because it's related to this redshift weighting. Once I have this, I can just look at the area on these graphs, on these projections that correspond to escape, so the non-shaded areas for each different redshift, and look at what the redshift is, and that allows me to calculate the flux as a function of the redshift. In particular, what I get are plots like these. Here I'm showing a black hole spin 99.8% of externality for these different prograde and retrograde orbiters. And we see we get plots like these. What's interesting to note is that the flux is, for the most part, proportional to the redshift value. So they are mostly linear profiles, but they have a specific feature that is a byte taken out of them, which is precisely the flux that gets captured by the black hole. So the hallmark of the black hole on the flux profile is not like a dark deficit region, like you would see if you were to look at like an image of a black hole, but instead would be these bytes taken out of the flux. It's also of note that as I take the black hole, the orbiter radius around the black hole to infinity, of course, these go to a delta spike. And they get broader as the black hole, as the orbiter radius approaches the ISCO or gets closer to the black hole. So the next thing, now that we've done this in general, is to talk about how do we do this in the case of externality, because there are some interesting caveats. So here again, I'm showing you the Kerr metric. And if you take the Kerr metric and consider it at externality, at simply A equals M, it turns out you miss a big chunk of the geometry. If you just set A equals to M, you no longer are considering the whole geometry of a black hole. And what you miss is called the neck region or the near extreme Kerr, near horizon, near extreme Kerr region. Excuse me, I'd have an extra near in there. Cross that out. There we go. Near extreme, near horizon extreme Kerr. In order to get this solution to the Einstein equation, which neck is, what we do is we can do a coordinate transformation like such, which relates the radius in the geometry and the spin of the black hole to this parameter kappa, which we take to be small. As we take kappa to be small and then expand the Kerr metric to first order, what we will be left with is the neck metric. And we get the same metric, and indeed, even though we find neck from an expansion of the Kerr geometry, neck itself does satisfy the Einstein's equation, and by itself is a solution. In and of itself is a black hole solution. But what we find if we, as we do this transformation and take the leading order pieces, we get the same geometry. Even if we consider different scalings labeled by this parameter P to the horizon. So we zoom into the horizon as we take kappa to be very small, but regardless of what rate we zoom into the horizon, as long as it's in this range, we'll still land on this geometry. This may make it seem like this P, the rate at which we zoom into this geometry, is unphysical, but it's actually very physical. Different radii scale to the geometry at different rates. The ISCO, for instance, will scale to the horizon with a P equals to 2/3. And there are different values for different radii in the geometry, and in particular, some of the photon shell radii, which parameterize our critical curve, also scale to the horizon. And in fact, this kind of teaches us that the real way we should think about the extreme geometry for a maximally spinning black hole is the extreme Kerr geometry with just the Kerr metric with A set to M, sewn together with consecutive necks, all stacked, labeled by P, different P's, with the one with the fastest scaling to the horizon one being P equals one. And then we have an infinite tower of all these different necks sewn together, labeled by different P's. By P's, I mean different P values. We call these P's neck bands. And so, in particular, if we're thinking about the critical curve, and we want to describe it, if we look at our alpha beta coordinates from Bardeen, in particular, we already at extremality, need to know about neck. If we try to just set A equals to M and draw the critical curve, what we get, this is here viewing a black hole from the equator, from the equatorial plane, we would only get this solid part of the critical curve, and we'd miss this whole line if we only considered setting A equals to M in all of our equations. Instead, again, we need to consider that neck scaling, in particular, the neck scaling with kappa raised to the P equals 1 to elucidate this piece of the critical curve for the photon shell radii that scale towards the horizon as we dial up the spin of the black hole. And so, by the same token, when we consider the orbiters, drawing the critical curve in the sky of the orbiters, again, we need this same kind of process where the critical curve splits into two pieces, the part for just extreme Kerr and the part for the neck radii. And so here I'm showing you an example of what the critical curve looks like for various radii that I've labeled here. And again, the solid segments come from the half that is extreme Kerr, while the dotted segments come from the part that scales into neck. All right, so this is interesting, but one thing that's a little different is that this doesn't describe for me what if my orbiter itself is scaling into neck. In that case, something even funnier happens. Again, the critical curve splits into two. For instance, if I consider an orbiter radius that scales into the horizon like the ISCO. In that case, to draw the critical curve, it would end up having this shape shown here in red. Again, it splits into two halves, but indeed it's not either. It's not the same scalings I need to consider as I did here to draw the critical curve. Instead, one half of the critical curve, if my orbiter scales to the horizon with the scaling Q, then one half of the critical curve comes from considering, again, the scaling of neck radii P equals 1, but the other half is not the extreme Kerr piece. Instead, it's the piece of neck orbiter described radii with P equals Q over 2. Now, this might seem weird. Why is it that I have to consider some Qs, some P's, some neckband scalings, and not others? Why in one case did I need to consider the ones that scale, that remain in extreme Kerr, while some scale into different P bands? Why did I not need to consider all P's? And it turns out the answer is actually you do. So if you think about the scaling to, if you think about looking at the critical curve and having it scale to all the way up to extremality and looking at all the different scalings to of the different photon shell radii for all the different P's, what you can look at is the values for my critical curve at extremality, and you can look at their first order corrections. And what you see is it's not that I don't need to consider all of them, it's just that as I dial up to extremality, certain ranges of P's labeling neckbands shrink down to points on my critical curve. In particular, like I showed you for the ISCO, I have the scaling of P equals 1 giving me half the critical curve. The other half is the scaling for P equals Q, the scaling of my emitters to the horizon divided by 2. That's this half. And in fact, the other ranges from Q over 2 to 1 for P map to these points, while all P less than Q equals 2 down to 0, which would be not scaling into the neck at all, come to this point on the critical curve. So it's not that they are completely negligible, it's just that once I dial all the way up to extremality, certain ranges of P's have collapsed into points on my critical curve. But really, if I'm slightly away from extremality, I really should be thinking about all P's. And so this gives us a hint at maybe a high spin perturbation theory way of thinking about the critical curve. And in fact, what we noticed also is that if you consider the near extremal case for which I had the critical curve on, and gray. You can approximate it with several P's. You could, you know, make an approximation where you use all of them, but you can get a really good approximation if you consider where the P, you consider different P's for which the correction to the value at extremality has a broken power law. So you can look at all the leading order corrections to my values at extremality and see where they're the behavior in which piece corrects the value at extremality changes its scaling behavior. And if you pick out these points where the scaling is broken, you can use those p-values to get a pretty good approximation piecewise of the critical curve in your extremality. So this isn't an idea we've completely fleshed out, but it's certainly an interesting one, leading us to an idea of how one might attempt to do a high spin perturbation theory. Often we think about phenomena around black holes that are Schwarzschild and move away from Schwarzschild by doing some kind of perturbation theory around Schwarzschild. So this is kind of a hint about how one might try to do perturbation theory around Kerr, where it wouldn't be as simple as only needing the extreme Kerr geometry. You would need to know a little bit about the mechanics of the near horizon extreme geometry, but this gives us a hint that it might be possible. But that was kind of a caveat. Going back to the fact that I now, at extremality, know how to draw my critical curve in the sky of my orbiters, I can, again, calculate the escape probability as well as the flux for the light that escapes from the orbiters. In particular, this means I can exactly calculate this purple curve, which is the case of maximum spin. The majority of this purple curve, in fact, all of it, pretty much, is the case of all the orbiters in the case where I had that first kind of scaling where I did not have my radius of my emitter scaling into neck. And in the case when my radius of my emitter does scale to neck, what I get is particular only this point here. This point here is for all neck radii. It turns out the critical curve I get for any radius that scales into neck is independent of what neck radius it is, of what P it uses to scale to neck. So the ISCO is one such radius that scales to the horizon, scales into neck, but several emitter radii scale into neck, and all of them have this same universal form for their critical curve, and thus this universal value for the escape probability, which I have given here. And in particular of note is that it's greater than 50%. So this is kind of surprising in a manner, because if you think about it, all the neck radii, like the ISCO, at least in Bleuler-Lindquist coordinates and whatnot, they appear to scale to the horizon as I spin the black hole up. And the horizon is usually thought to be the point at which you can get no light escaping once you've crossed it, once you're at it. So you would assume that as you approach a radius that approaches the horizon, that you might expect that all of your escape probability as you get closer and closer to the horizon would, in fact, start to vanish and smoothly go to zero. So it's really fascinating to think about. You maybe have seen those videos where someone says, oh, this is what it looks like to fall into a black hole. And as you get closer and closer, the area that is black from the black hole capturing light gets bigger and bigger and starts to envelop all of your sky as you could look around in any direction. But in fact, if you're not falling into the black hole, even if you are very close to the horizon on one of these circular equatorial orbits in the neck, less than half of your sky is taken up by the black hole, and more than half the light you emit still escapes the black hole. And further, this should be a big hint that perhaps the neck is, even for black holes that are rapidly spinning, this neck geometry should potentially then be very observable. And in particular, for the case of the flux from the neck emitters. Again, like I said, just like the probability is independent of which neck radius, so is the flux. We have a universal form given this form here. And in particular, one thing of note is that the most blue-shifted point in the flux that you get, the most blue-shifted photons have a G that is equal to root 3. And further, this G equals root 3 is the from all the emitters around the black hole, if they're on these circular equatorial orbits, if you think about, say, building up a disk by adding a bunch of these orbiters, this is the bluest light you would get from any orbiter around the black hole on a circular equatorial orbit. So, in fact, this is quite nice because you see that the neck, the closest radii to the black hole, although you think about being closer to the black hole as being more and more redshift, it's also more and more blue-shifted as well. So this comes to the general idea of observability. Now, the one biggest caveat for the idea of this having to be related to observability is that this is a flux to the entire celestial sphere. In general, of course, we observe black holes from a specific observer position on the celestial sphere, not the whole celestial sphere. So if one was to attempt to, from a single black hole, observe this, you would need to somehow like have the black hole surrounded by a bunch of observers who could then send all that information to each other to be collated. And if you're looking at a black hole that has a disk, then you also need to add up the flux from these radii, like these here, you have to superimpose them, but they then have to be weighted by the emissivity at each radius in the disk. But if we think about just the case of the blue shift though, this is actually a little, even though we don't know anything about the emissivity, this is actually kind of something that we might potentially be able to use. The most blue-shifted photons, the very left edge, always come from the radii closer and closer to the black hole, and the closest one, at least in this model for these circular equatorial orbits that are stable, is the ISCO. So the ISCO always sources our most blue-shifted light that we would receive. And further, it turns out that this bluest light, these edge points of all these flux curves, is always from the light that is emitted in the direction of travel of these orbiters. And thus, it always only reaches the celestial sphere at the equator. So if we just think about using the most blue-shifted light, if we are observing the black hole from the equator, we could actually use this value of most blue-shifted light to tell us or constrain what the spin of the black hole is. And so one might ask, though, okay, this is all good and dandy, but what about general observer angles that are not the equator of the celestial sphere? In this case, it turns out this is a harder problem to do using the methods that I've described above previously. But in principle, one could do it. What one would have to do is take the sky of the observer, and in it, map all the curves of fixed observer angle using the Kerr geodesics. And here on the area preserving projection, I'm shown a couple examples of what that might look like. So here I have a black hole at 90 spinning 90% of extremality. The critical curve is this black curve here. The interior of the critical curve is the region that is captured, and the outer of the critical curve corresponds to the directions for light that escapes the celestial sphere. And then I've colored these regions with these curves that correspond to where on the celestial sphere or horizon they land. So if I look then at the area outside of the critical curve, I can draw these curves of constant observer angle on the celestial sphere. And of course, what you see is you get multiple mappings of the curves to where they land on the celestial sphere, because we have multiple images of the emission around the black hole because we have that photon shell region where light can wind multiple times around the black hole before going off to infinity. Here, I've also shown the case of a black hole at 98% of externality, just for comparison. And you see they look kind of different. In principle, one could get the flux. Oh, these, let me also both say, excuse me, these orbiters, the radius of these orbiters is for both the ISCO. I forgot to. In principle, then one could still graphically find the flux by tiling these projections with curves of also constant redshift, and then make these curves very fine, very close together, very fine-grained, and then you could bin them by redshift and observer angle and add up all the little bins of constant observer angle and constant redshift to be able to figure out what the flux is, weighting by redshift. Okay, even though one could do this, it's very difficult, and it's not something we've attempted to do. Let me also say, though, a little easier than trying to find the flux would be trying to find the maximum blue shift from one of these orbiters to a fixed angle. All you would have to do is pick which observing angle you want, and then draw the curves of that observer angle on these projections, and then just figure out the farthest they go out in radius, because the way we've set up the projections, the farther out in radius they are, that corresponds to being at greater and greater redshift, or larger and larger redshift value, more blue shifted. But like I said, this is difficult. And then of course you would need to do it for all source radii in the disk, and compare them. And it turns out it's a very difficult thing, but in principle, perhaps kind of doable. But instead what this led to, let me just briefly mention, was another project that we did, which has to do with the observing from a specific angle, but doing the calculation all in the frame of the observer, not in the frame of these orbiters that are emitting the light. And this is related to the idea of what is really used often to try to constrain the spins of observed black holes, which has the term X-ray reflection method. So you can, in the frame of the observer, you can numerically, you can calculate the flux. Once you've picked an emissivity profile, you can calculate the flux from such a disk model, like this equatorial disk with circular equatorial orbits around a curved black hole. You can numerically figure out what the flux is. And you can do this for all spins and all observer inclinations. And then you can make a library from which you can compare the broadened emission, the broadened line emission from an observed source to try to constrain your spin. And this has been done with data from XMM Newton and Suzaku, and roughly about 20 black holes have had their spins constrained using this method. So this is something one can do numerically and something that's been done before, but like I said, it depends on, for instance, your emissivity profile. If we're after something a little more universal that doesn't have to do with us picking emissivity profile, regardless of what the emissivity profile is, we still can consider the maximum observable blue shift. Like I showed before, in the other method, we were able to do the case for the equatorial plane, because it turned out that was always from the ISCO, the bluest light was from the light shot from the orbiters in the forward direction. So one can still consider the maximum observable blue shift, which in this case corresponds to these leftmost edges of these broadened line profiles. Specifically, these ones produced here that I'm showing for two different inclinations, 30 degrees and 85 degrees, come from this code called Redline by Dowser, and was given to my colleagues and I by Laura Brenneman. And so it's showing the original, and these faint lines here is the original emission energy in the frame of the emitters, which is which is the one they most prominently use experimentally, is the K-alpha line, and then we've shown the broadened profiles around them. And we see that for all of these, regardless of the angle we observe from or what spins we consider, the value for the maximum observable blue shift has non-vanishing flux. And it has some interesting features which we could question, like at low inclination angle close to the spin axis of the black hole, they seem to have a common value regardless of spin, while once we're at a higher inclination, it becomes spin independent, etc. And so what we were after was just this maximum observable value in another paper that we did that was related. Let me put the number here. 0.3310. And so we answered the question by just not worrying about what the emissivity is, only considering the maximum observable blue shift. To do this, you can look at the black hole's disk as seen by a faraway observer. You can look at all the lensed image, the direct light from the disk, as well as here I'm showing the first lensed image. You can color it by blue shift, and numerically you can find the value where the maximum blue shift occurs on each of the images. And then you can, once you've found it for each of the images, find the overall maximum observable blue shift. And when we did that, we were able to get these numerical graphs. We were able to get these curves numerically that show the values here. I'll describe just briefly what I'm showing. I'm showing for different spins what the color curves show what the maximum observable blue shift was. And then I have a couple of also analytic curves that we were able to use as approximations. We have this black curve that fits all the curves since they have a common maximum observable blue shift when we're observing near the pole. And then along the axis of this of the equatorial observer, I have these points, which are also analytically calculated instead of numerically, which describe what we see when we're viewing from the equator. This is the case that I was able to show when I was in the observer frame. And then we also have this orange curve I'll show you here. Of note, with these colored curves here, all the ones in this top panels, where this right-hand panel is just a blow-up of this area here. Likewise down here, this panel is just a blow-up of this area here. In the top panels, the maximum observable blue shift only came from the direct image, while for the higher spins, it may come from a lensed image, and that's why these curves have kinks. Like this blue one goes here, and then it has its kink, and that's when the maximum observable blue shift switches to being on the first lensed image of the disk, with the dotted line showing what the maximum observable blue shift from just the direct light was. And so, all in all, I won't go into too much detail, but these are the approximations of the different regimes. But in general, just for the interest of time, let me wrap here and summarize all the results. So the first part of the talk, we were able to generalize the notion of the critical curve or the black hole shadow for circular equatorial orbiters in the bulk, not just on the boundary of the celestial sphere. And in doing so, we were able to use projections to describe properties of isotropic monochromatic emission from these orbiters, namely the escape probability and the flux as a function of the redshift. Then we considered specifically the case of high spin, the extremal regime. And this gave us an interesting hint when we looked at when we figured out how to draw the critical curve about perhaps in the future, elucidating this idea of high spin perturbation theory. On the side of the properties, the escape probability and the flux, what we learned is that more than half of the light from an emitter in the neck escapes the black hole, which means that the neck indeed may be visible, that the flux from the neck region is universal no matter which radius in the neck we are at, and that the most blue-shifted photons come from the neck and can potentially be used to constrain the spin of the black hole if we're observing from the equator, which led us then to think about using the maximum observable blue shift to constrain the spin of a black hole when we're away from the pathway. In that case, we find that indeed we can, to some degree, use the flux from, we can use the maximum observable blue shift, which has non-vanishing flux. Not we're saying exactly what it is since we didn't pick an emissivity profile, but we know that it's non-vanishing, and we can use that to constrain the spin or observation angle of the black hole. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Lala, for the talk. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I think I'll try one.
Mm-hmm. Eric?
So thank you for the talk. When you were describing all the weird properties that happen when you go in the near extreme limit.
Yes.
I mean, I was reminded there was a paper by Ted Jacobson, maybe about 10 years ago, maybe, where he was looking at those weird limits where everything seems to pile up on the horizon in the limit.
Mm-hmm.
As basically a bad feature of Boyle-Lindquist coordinates that go away if you're doing something else with horizon-penetrating coordinates. And he was using a variant of the Payne-Levy-Goldstein coordinates that's been generalized to a Kerr black hole. So his basic observation is that in the extreme limit, all the weirdness that happens in Boyle-Lindquist coordinates basically goes away because you're not trying to approach the horizon through a t-equal constant slice, but you're doing it through slices that penetrate the horizon. So I guess that's a long-winded question, but my question is, have you looked into this? Have you looked at doing the calculation in those types of coordinates to see if you can, you know, maybe get something a little bit simpler coming out?
I will look into this paper. This is a paper I wasn't aware of. This feature of needing near horizon coordinates, there are other coordinates other than Boyer-Lindquist that do require them. And I didn't realize I hadn't yet been made aware of a set of coordinates, for instance, these ones that you say Ted Jacobson has described, which are penetrate the horizon that didn't have the feature where you needed a near horizon scaling. So I was not aware of these, and I'll look into it. Though this isn't as, at least it was my understanding before this question, was this is, even though Boyer-Lindquist coordinates are one, a set of coordinates that, like you said, don't penetrate the horizon, that this wasn't a feature of the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates themselves, that other coordinates are also needed this near horizon scaling limit. And so I wasn't aware, like I said, that there were such a set of coordinates that did not need these near extremal limits. So I will look into that. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, so I might have represented this wrong because the details are far away in my memory, but I mean, I think it's probably worth taking a look.
Absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, my previous understanding, at least before this question, was that this wasn't a feature of the fact that the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates don't penetrate the horizon. But that doesn't mean there do not exist a set of coordinates which do not need this kind of limit. I just previously wasn't aware of such that existed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great. We have a question from Luis.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Delilah. I had a question. So on this, all this work on near extreme Kerr, so you have some conclusions. How would you, of course, there are people out there that may or may not think that that may think that black holes in nature will be highly spinning.
Right.
I tend to be more conservative. I don't think the evidence is that strong that there are very highly spinning black holes. So how can I take away, or what would you say I can take away from the senior extreme to the more mundane world of black holes with not crazily high spinnings?
Yeah, this is a good question. I guess two things. Especially since the first part of the talk, I didn't talk about high spin. So I guess, at least namely for me, when you don't think about the high spin, you still, for instance, can use the notion of the most, for instance, like I was talking about the maximum observable blue shift, that to constrain spins, for instance, is generic. You don't need to be all the way up to maximal spin for that, or close to it. And, you know, it fails more and more as but one could, if one is willing to say, set a bound like, I don't know, the Thorn bound or something, or say something like there may be some upper bound. That doesn't mean one, for at least I don't know specifically because it hasn't been quite as elucidated, but the notion of perhaps these results being related to a high spin perturbation theory that still isn't saying the exactly extremal result being useful is perhaps, I think, maybe a nice hint, and by which I mean to say, even if you have maybe a spin closer to extremality, so above 50%, than it is to Schwarzschild, perhaps this leads us towards the direction of maybe we'll be able to come up with a high spin perturbation theory as well as a Schwarzschild perturbation theory, perturbation theories around Schwarzschild, where we can kind of meet in the middle and see how well, you know, expanding from either end gives us a result for a generic spin.
But I guess then my question is, if you think, so in the first part of your talk where you are not in the high extreme limit, so either I can do something there that is sufficiently generic that if I want to evaluate at spin 0.999, then I go ahead and do it. Or you're elucidating or uncovering something pretty neat that happens at a very high spin regime. And then the question is there some relics of that that are still left over at lower spin values? So I guess that I'd be interesting to know where such a possibility you think exists.
Ah, I see. Yeah, this is a question I'm not so sure I have a definite answer for.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, any more questions? I actually had one. So you mentioned this cute possibility that using this maximum observable blue shift, one would be able to either sort of measure the spin or the inclination angle. But then looking at some of the plots here, it seems like some of the curves actually cross. So even if you knew one of the parameters, say the inclination or the inclination angle here, for example, or the spin, it would still be hard to determine the other parameters. So how would you actually go about this?
The first thing to notice is for the low inclinations close to the spin axis of the black hole, we see that all of the kind of maximum observable blue shifts really line up. So really this is for the low inclination or inclinations close to the spin axis of the black hole, this is only really telling us information about the inclination and nothing about, really good about the inclination, but very nothing about the spin. As we get closer to the, as we're closer to the, higher, observing angles or inclinations closer to the, equatorial plane of the for this disk model, we start to be able to do constrain spin in terms, spin and inclination in terms of each other. But like you said, the curves cross, so there's a degeneracy. But potentially, if you know, for instance, the inclination very well because of a jet, that would give you one piece, and then you'd be able to back out the spin from that. So if you could get the information another way, which would be reasonable if you had a jet, for instance, it could be quite useful for constraining both. Otherwise, it's really just kind of telling you about a region in which they could lie, where you have a degeneracy.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm just wondering. I'm, as a theorist, I'm a little more skeptical that the opening angle of the jet, or in general the observer angle, can be known to. It seems like you need like a precision of like a few degrees or so. Potentially here, so that will be challenging, but certainly, yeah, a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That's nice. Okay, any final questions or thoughts? Okay, well, if not, let's thank Dalila again for a very nice talk, and we'll still stay here on the call for another couple of minutes or so, just in case people want to chat a little more. Other than that, thanks everyone, and see you actually next year in January. This was-